This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The Bloomington City Council will discuss this evening whether the city should have an independent citizen police review board.
I have lost confidence that they have the capacity to review themselves, which makes me hesitant to call them if I witness something.
GLT's Judy Valente talks with a Bloomington couple who filed a complaint against the police. The Bloomington City Council will discuss police community relations during a meeting this evening at 5:30. Get a preview of a behavioral health forum. It's tied to an effort to improve mental health care in the county. GLT's Charlie Schlenker talks with McLean County Administrator Bill Wasson. And during an edition of What's on Your Turntable, you'll hear a folk rock band who played an Illinois Wesleyan University concert in 1970. All of that, plus a GLT News update on the way. It's May 15th, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The Bloomington City Council is discussing tonight a proposal from five community groups to establish an independent, citizen-led review board. That panel would receive and oversee complaints about the police. Some maintain the current process for filing complaints is too intimidating. GLT's Judy Valente talks with two Bloomington residents about their experience when they sought to file a complaint about an arrest they had witnessed.
On a warm summer evening in July 2015, Sophie Charles and Henry Dick, a couple who live in West Bloomington, watched police respond to an altercation involving teenagers in their neighborhood. Then they saw police question a man who happened to be crossing Market Street at the same time with his partner and their child. The man began gesturing, tapping his ear and his hand. Charles and Dick soon realized that both the man and his wife are deaf and that the man had been gesturing for a notepad to write responses for the police. They tried to explain to officers that their neighbor had nothing to do with the fight, but the deaf man was soon in handcuffs. Police charged him with resisting arrest. The next day, Charles and Dick went to the police department to file a complaint about the officer's conduct. They are white. Their neighbor, who was arrested, is black. They say they were dissatisfied with both the complaint process and the outcome of the police internal investigation.
We realized that it was important for us to speak up about what we had seen. And so the next morning, we went to the Bloomington Police Department to file an official complaint. And they took us into a back room. And the very first thing that they did was ask us for our first and last names, and then they left the room. And then when they came back, they asked Henry, the officer asked Henry, "Oh, are you still living at that address on Washington Street?" Which is where he grew up. He hasn't lived there in years. However, what that indicated to us was that they were looking into us. You know, that you come in to make a complaint on us, we're checking into you too. Which I think, since that experience has felt like an intimidation tactic, or at least something that makes people feel that they cannot come in there and voice a complaint without feeling that they are already, their credibility is being questioned. And I do believe that this is a process that should be available to people who have no criminal record and people who do have criminal records.
Maybe they were just checking to see if you had a criminal record. Would that be such a wrong thing, Henry?
Do I think it's wrong for them to investigate people who witness a situation? Not necessarily. But will that make it so people don't file complaints? Without question. It made me hesitate, and I have no criminal background.
Go ahead, Sophie.
And we already were intimidated by the fact that we were at the police department, speaking to a police officer, a colleague of the people we now had a complaint about. and asking them to investigate their colleagues. So already, that was a very intimidating process to have to go to the police department.
So then what was the rest of the process like, filing your complaint at the police department?
Mm-hmm. So we were told that this process would be confidential, that we would give our statement, and then it would take them 30 to 60 days to investigate the complaint. So meanwhile, his criminal charges are moving forward, while the police department has 30 to 60 days to decide whether there was any wrongdoing on their part. So though that was still a very real concern of ours, so we sat down with the officer and gave our statement. And I think through that process, we felt pretty very much that they were trying to placate us, that what we were sharing with the officer was not something that gave them cause for concern or alarm, but that the process was there for us to feel better that somebody was listening to it. I did not get the impression that they were taking seriously the concerns that we had about a civil rights violation on a protected population.
Was that your reaction as well, Henry?
It was. And as a result of that, we requested to talk to somebody higher up. So we ended up sitting with Assistant Chief Sutherland for about an hour. I believe he's now retired.
Gary Sutherland. Yes, he's now retired.
Mm-hmm. We sat with him for about an hour, and he was a very good listener, but it felt like he was doing his best to kind of soften the way we felt, which is fine.
Did he have an explanation as to why this incident resulted in a resisting arrest charge?
Mostly the message he was trying to communicate was that this process is a very long process, and that at best, and this is where we started to get really frustrated, at best, they would get the process done in 60 days. And that's all he was trying to communicate. We tried to draw more out of him about what their thoughts are on this, and he said, we will investigate, we will investigate, we will investigate, but it takes a long time, and we're overworked, and it's difficult to get this process done. And to me, it just seemed like they were trying to create more and more leeway for themselves. That was the priority of this conversation.
And so we asked to speak to somebody higher up, which was Chief Hefner himself. And we did sit and talk with Chief Hefner again about these same concerns. And ultimately, he came out with the same result.
We're talking with Sophie Charles and Henry Dick. They are residents of West Bloomington, and they're talking about the need for a possible citizen review board of police complaints. Then did you seek to go higher up over the chief's head, say?
So at that same day, we went to State's Attorney Jason Chambers' office, because that's ultimately what Chief Hefner said was that after the charges have been filed, it's in his office. The ball is in his court. So then we tried to talk to him about what we saw. Basically, we talked to the person at the front desk. She said that Jason would call us, and we said we would really like to talk to somebody if we can. So a paralegal came out, I believe, and she also said that Jason was very busy. And we talked about the gravity of the situation, where somebody who has a disability was not given accommodation, and instead was criminally charged, and still we couldn't get any sort of way to file anything with the state's attorney's office. The best we could do was leave with assurances that Jason Chambers would call us, which he didn't, which was also frustrating. The day after we finalized our formal complaint with the police department, the same paddy wagon, the van that was driven by the arresting officer, it was parked across the street from our house.
What did you make of that?
It confirmed for us that it was not a confidential process, that what we had been assured when we went in to file the complaint had not been the case. And we felt very intimidated, very threatened.
At that point, we stopped communicating with the police department. We stopped communicating with the state's attorney's office.
What would you like to see change about the complaint process?
I think that based on our experience, it would have been very beneficial to have an a separate entity to be able to go to file our complaints, to feel that there was a certain level of confidentiality, that there would not be retaliation for simply filing a complaint for something that concerned us, that we saw happening in the neighborhood. So an independent body who we would be able to go to file this complaint, who would be able to investigate further. So 71 days after we filed our complaint, we did get a letter from Chief Sutherland, Assistant Chief Sutherland, that our testimony was, what was the wording? Something about our claims were unfounded, our testimony was unsustained, and that ultimately the officers were exonerated.
So how did you feel then about that, Henry?
Through my experience with the complaint process, I have lost confidence that they have the capacity to review themselves, which makes me hesitant to call them if I have a problem, which makes me hesitant to call them if I witness something, because I'm worried about my neighbors who have not done anything wrong. I'm worried about the black residents walking through my neighborhood who are just trying to go about their daily lives. And through this experience, I have learned that when the police are involved, I am putting my neighbors at risk. So something needs to happen here.
Sophie Charles and Henry Dick, I want to thank you for coming in and chatting about this.
Thanks so much for having us. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for having us.
I'm Judy Valente.
The resisting arrest charge was eventually dropped against the deaf man from West Bloomington. There were 17 complaints filed against Bloomington police in 2016. In two cases, the complaints against officers were upheld. Sophie Charles and Henry Dick say they want an independent civilian board to not only receive citizen complaints, but investigate those complaints. You're listening to Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from Jack Baytall Real Estate Group at Keller Williams. Jack and his team are committed to helping Bloomington Normal continue to thrive by giving back to GLT and other local nonprofits. Current listings at jacksguarantee.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's an edition of GLT's date book ahead. You'll hear about a fundraiser for the Knapp Byrne Foundation. That's ahead during Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. McLean County government leaders say they hope a lot of people show up for a community forum on behavioral health issues. That's Thursday afternoon at the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts. It's tied to the recent start of the jail expansion and how the county wants to continue improving mental health care in the area as the state abandons that role. GLT's Charlie Schlenker talks with McLean County administrators, or rather talks with the McLean County administrator, to preview the forum and its importance for the community.
The Behavioral Health Community Forum is an opportunity for the county as a whole and all its partners to be able to share information about programs and activities that are taking place in the community, that are contemplated in the community, to help address the needs we have relating to both behavioral and mental illness and health.
How will the day unfold?
So the day, of course, is Thursday, May 18th. Activities begin at 1 p.m. at the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts. We will have 50-minute breakout sessions. On the half hour, at 1:30, 2:30, 3:30, and 4:30, we will have several different options that individuals will have to attend breakout sessions on different topics that, again, relate to behavioral and mental health within the community.
What are some of these, and how do you propose to handle them?
We've got a pretty wide range. They include topics like supportive housing, behavioral crisis response. We do have a program on opiate addiction and abuse, which is a growing issue within the region. And we also have some sessions that relate to faith-based services within the community, as well as some of the more data-driven processes that we hope will assist in developing programs that are targeted for the right people at the right times to try and give them the most benefit and allow them to be productive, functioning members of our community, and also have a positive impact upon the overusage of emergency rooms, EMS services, law enforcement services as well.
How will this event move the community forward in the overarching goal of the last 5 years of making services more robust and better coordinated?
Back in 2014, the county board put together a couple of work groups, and those two work groups were comprised of stakeholders to try and involve them in the development of what in 2015 became the county's mental health plan. One of the things that is outlined in that plan is to do community education, public education relative to this subject to try and reduce the stigma of mental illness within our community. And this forum is targeted for the general public to try and give them additional information on areas that we think are really important and insightful, and hopefully to be able to educate them about how they can assist and participate with us in moving the community forward.
Conferences always have keynote speeches. So what's this one?
Yeah, so our keynote speaker is John Fallon. John Fallon is a senior program manager for the Corporation for Supportive Housing. And the Corporation for Supportive Housing has been to the community a couple of times. I'm working with I know, the League of Women Voters, with Mark First, with Baby Fold, to have conversations about supportive housing within our community and the needs that exist for supportive housing and affordable housing within the community. John's been in the field for over 35 years. He's worked in both public and private settings. We believe that his message, along with the expertise and knowledge that he brings from the Corporation for Supportive Housing, can be an important assistance to our community in moving forward. So he will talk about different types of programs that have been successful in other locations and talk about possibilities for our community.
McLean County Administrator Bill Wasson talking with GLT's Charlie Schlenker about the Community Behavioral Health Forum Tuesday from 1 to 6 p.m. at the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts. Wednesday's edition of GLT's Sound Ideas will be devoted entirely to the topics in the forum. It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The state legislative session ends in 2 weeks. It'll end with the state 2 years overdue on a state budget. The Illinois Politics Roundtable chews on those unpleasant tastes. This week, Sean Crawford moderates with panelists Charlie Wheeler and Chris Mooney of the University of Illinois at Springfield, IPR's Brian Mackey, and John O'Connor of the Associated Press.
I have run out of words to guess about the budget. You know, we have some newcomers in the press room this year, and they're always amazed at how seemingly little gets done during a legislative session. I pointed out to one of them on Wednesday that Minority Leader in the Senate, Christine Rodonio, on a Daniel Biss bill, asked that it be pulled out of the record because this is only May 10th. And it's true. Now, this is the same woman who later in the afternoon said, we only have 10 days or 20 days. So it's all relative. May 10th is early in terms of what the legislature can get done by the time of its constitutionally mandated May 31st adjournment. On the other hand, this is the third May 10th that we've seen with no budget action, third in a row. We've had no budget, no full-time budget, annual budget since June of 2015. And anyway, the onus, I think, is on the governor. He needs, I think he is in a position now. He hasn't said he's going to run for re-election in 2018, but all signs point to that being the case. And it's hard for me to imagine campaigning on, I stopped Mike Madigan from imposing a tax increase for 4 years. Yes, we don't have a budget, but I just don't see that being a, you know, and you can't campaign on the state is broken, the system is broken. By the way, reelect me for another 4 years.
Well, and that's just the question, though, because he is campaigning on that. And he, even though he hasn't had, as John said, he hasn't had sort of a big formal announcement to say he is running for reelection. He has said that in response to questions, I think, almost a year ago that he would run again. I don't think there's really
any question.
And he put
$50 million in his bank account to run, so I think that's probably a clue.
And that. Yeah, but he is telling his supporters, I protected you from the Democratic tax increase that they want to impose without any reforms, is how he would say it. Of course, the Democrats would say, no, we've actually said we would think you need a balanced approach, as Speaker Madigan would say, of both revenue increases and spending cuts. But, you know, if the governor is telling that to his supporters already, if he's already saying, I've protected you from a tax hike, a lot of people are wondering, a lot of Democrats are wondering, is he sincere about still coming to some kind of deal that both Republicans and Democrats, the governor and the legislative leaders have all said we're going to need higher taxes as well as spending cuts in order to dig us out of this deep and getting deeper by the minute financial hole that the state is in?
Well, Chris, I was going to come to you. The governor, of course, has been around talking about, you know, where he stands on some of these issues. I thought Senator Cullerton's comment that Republicans, and I think he's talking specifically the governor, he's saying they don't know how to govern. I mean, that's a pretty strong statement.
Yeah, it's a strong statement. I think it's a reflection of the frustration that is felt under the dome. And I'm not down there as much as the rest of the people on the panel are, but every time I talk to people down there, just depression, frustration, anger, both sides. You know, it's an equal opportunity set of emotions right now because it's not good for anybody what's going on. I know it's been mentioned here many times. Every single day, we're going deeper and deeper into debt, and that's going to make it harder and harder for this thing to get solved and more painful for each one of us who are paying taxes in the state of Illinois to get solved. But, you know, one of the things I will notice that is a contrast between, you know, the hangdog, depressed look that people have, and all the legislators, when you see them, the leaders in pictures in the paper, none of them are having any fun whatsoever. The governor is he is so focused and so on message. It's like, everything comes at, you know, they're booing. Number one, the fact that he's got the guts to go up to Chicago State, which I think enrolled 86 freshmen in the fall after giving out or taking away the keys from all their employees sort of a day or two before they had the first stopgap budget a year ago, April. He is really making an effort in his vision of the world to help Chicago State. He's bringing in people like Paul Vallis, really trying to make that happen. And he goes there, and you know, so that's a gutsy move. And then when he gets booed, he spins it in such a just didn't skip a beat. Just boom, yeah, I'm me too. I'm with you. We're all together. A little negative feedback, but I'm with you on that. This guy has not lost energy. He is not. I mean, maybe in behind the scenes, maybe goes home and kicks his dog, but I don't know. He's looking pretty cool. He's the coolest customer yet.
Yeah, and Cullerton wasn't criticizing all Republicans. He was criticizing the governor and the people with whom he surrounded himself, many of whom come from the congressional experience, who Cullerton believes, don't have the experience of working in a give-and-take type of situation that occurs when you're the governor of a state and have to deal with a legislature controlled by the opposite party. And that was the case for most Republican governors during my time of watching this. I don't think Jim Thompson ever had, in his 14 years, a Republican-controlled General Assembly. The Republicans had the House for 2 years out of that time. So all the rest of his tenure, he was dealing with legislature controlled by Democrats, and yet he got an awful lot done. So I'm thinking if Governor Rauner is going to run for reelection and he's going to run on, I stop Mike Madigan from raising your taxes, a voter might say, well, what have you done positively? You look at it objectively, the state's bill backlog is double, maybe triple what it was when you came into office. Our credit rating has been knocked down several notches. Our universities are about ready to go belly up. Other than being there to block the evil Mike Madigan, what can you tell us that you've done for us? Is Illinois better off after 4 years of you than it was before you came into office?
Well, you know, on the other side of the coin, Rauner's team, I would assume, at this point, still thinks that they, you know, may be able to ride to the rescue on this thing, and that there may be that may be able to turn it around this month, you know, before the fiscal year or whatever, to come up with a budget. You know, I don't know if that's I don't know what the odds on that are. You know, every day that goes by, I think they're less, and they probably didn't start it at a too high of a number to start with. But if they believe that's what it is, he believes he is holding the line. He thinks he knows what's right, and he is, you know, he refuses to bend, to waver from the true path that he and his people, funders, you know, and staff, you know, other people he listens to, believe is the right way for Illinois to go forward.
Well, Chris, let me ask you, and that's what people seem to say they want politicians to do. They want politicians to be strong. They want them to you know, hold to their guns a lot of times. People want somebody who has, you know, some values when they come in, that's what they want to see done.
Well, and especially, I should put it this way. I think I would amend your statement and say people want politicians that stick to their guns and hold to their values when I agree with those values.
Well, true.
When I don't agree with those values, what I want them to do is listen to reason, you know, come together, let's compromise. And in fact,
what we're seeing right now are groups such as school districts, 400 and some school districts saying, make a deal, do something. You've got suburban mayors who are saying, no property tax freeze, just do something. And we're to that point. I think people did like the idea of Rauner sticking to his guns, but it's not getting him anywhere. And Cullerton's point was, you're not going to get – Cullerton earlier, a few weeks ago, in March, I think, said, this guy is all for compromise as long as he gets 100% of what he wants. And that's – and he kind of said that again the other day in a different way, that he doesn't know how to make a deal. He doesn't realize that he's not going to get everything, so he takes what he can get and runs with it.
Yeah, and, John, I think you mentioned schools are complaining. And this is – you know, we've kept schools open for a couple of years. Court orders have kept – Medup money for certain programs going out. State employees have been paid thanks to one judge's decision down in southern Illinois in the Metro East area. So state government to the large population of Illinois appears to be limping along, functioning. Yeah, there's problems. But, you know, people in Illinois have been hearing about how corrupt and terrible state government is for a generation now. And so I think that they've kind of written it off. We've seen polling from Southern Illinois University's Paul Simon Public Policy Institute that says most people say, a majority of people in Illinois say the budget impasse has not affected them. Where I think you could begin to have problems is if we have not yet settled what's going to happen with the schools next year. And in the past couple of years, the legislature and the governor came together to fund keeping the schools open, at least. I should say the first year it was kind of the governor surprising people by vetoing the entire budget except for schools. Last year he cut a deal with between Democrats and Republicans to keep the schools open as part of that stopgap budget. This year, will they do that again?
Well, if they don't open the schools in the fall, that's the way this gets done fast, because there's no way that the parents of Illinois are going to wait 2, 3, 4 days even for this to get solved, because they want their kids back in school for many reasons. You know, come August,
you want those
kids in school.
Chris Mooney and Charlie Weaver of the University of Illinois at Springfield, IPR's Brian Mackey, and John O'Connor of AP. The Illinois Politics Roundtable is moderated by Sean Crawford. Its Sound Ideas, a huge predatory fish with big teeth that looks like something from prehistoric times, is coming back to Illinois. It's called the alligator gar, and at one time was part of the ecosystem in the southern part of the state. It's been gone for nearly 50 years. Dan Stevenson, the head of the State Fisheries Division, is working to reintroduce the species to waterways. IPR Sean Crawford has that interview.
Why is it important to bring this fish back?
Well, the alligator gar were an apex predator, the top of the food chain in Illinois in the southern part of the state. They were never found statewide. So we've got an opportunity now working with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to bring them back. So we thought, well, let's try to bring them back. We don't know if we'll be successful, but we're going to try.
One of the things that I think people may hear about this fish is just how big this fish is. I mean, it's the heaviest I saw that was caught in Illinois, weighed 176 pounds and was about 8 feet or longer. That's a pretty big fish. Makes somebody think of an alligator. It's not an alligator, though. It does have teeth, but it's not an alligator.
That's right. It's a fish. They're the second largest species in North America behind the sturgeons the white sturgeons that are found out in the northwest part of the country. They can get real big down in Texas, I believe, and I know the North American record is about 300 pounds, so they do get really big. We're kind of, here in Illinois, we've always been at the very northern extent of their range. There never were, you know, super abundant in the southern part of the state, but we were within their range. But if you go down to Louisiana, Texas, you'll find them a lot more down there.
What happened to cause this fish to disappear in Illinois? Because I think I read the last one was believed to have been caught in the mid-60s.
Yes. A lot of it, habitat change, and you hear that from many species of animal that you have trouble with, an endangered or a threatened species. You just habitat is generally the biggest problem. And then also, because they got big and the teeth and everything, people didn't like them. So there was a lot of, you catch them and kill them immediately. And there's still some of that done with the other gar. We have three native species of gar that are found all over in our rivers and streams, the short-nosed gar, spotted gar, and long-nosed gar. And we still have a lot of that. People don't like them for whatever reason.
Well, you mentioned earlier they are considered a predator, and there being such a large fish, I believe there's been some thought that these fish could really help with controlling invasive species, and specifically, I assume we're talking mostly about Asian carp.
Yeah, there was talk of that. A report got out last year, last August, I think, that's one of the reasons we were stocking them, and that is not true at all. There's never going to be enough in there to have any impact whatsoever on the Asian carp. You know, when you look at the Asian carp population, just as an example, in the LaGrange pool, which is over due west of here in Springfield on the Illinois River, there's about 13 tons of Asian carp per river mile. So, you know, there's just no way this fish can take them. And it also, if you look at the fish's mouth, its gape, it can't take a very big predator or a prey species. And so the Asian carp grows so quickly, within just a few months, they're too big for even the biggest of alligator gars to take. Studies have been done, food studies have been done, and their primary diet is gizzard shad, which is kind of the primary diet of all predators here in the state of Illinois, whether it's largemouth bass, smallmouth bass, muskie, walleye, whatever. It's all gizzard shad is the prey species that they prefer.
So is there any concern that they could throw off the natural balance by bringing, you know, the species back, or would there not be enough of them to do something like that?
And there wouldn't, and there is, and they were actually part of the natural balance when they were here. So the natural balance is actually thrown off now. This is moving back towards where we've got some kind of a natural balance. Although, you know, all their stream systems are so disturbed now with the locks and dams that have been put on the larger ones, and the Asian carp are now in all rivers and streams in the Midwest. They're really pretty much the Asian carp are from the Appalachian Mountains all the way to the Rocky Mountains in all the river systems. So we got really disturbed systems now, but we do have a chance to bring back something that was here at one time, and that's why we're trying this.
From a fisherman's standpoint, is it worthwhile to catch these fish if they do become more populated? Can they be eaten, and you know, are they good to eat, things like that?
Generally speaking, people don't eat them, although I know the people that do eat them really like them. But when they get real big like that, they're strictly a trophy type species. Down south in Texas and in Louisiana, where they're more abundant, they actually have guide services, something like you would see if you went to Canada going for muskies or something like that. You'd hire a guide to take you out fishing for muskie or walleye. Or here in Illinois, you have guides to take you out for bass fishing or crappie fishing. Down south, they take you out looking for these big monster trophies down south, let's say Texas, as I mentioned, and Louisiana. They take you out fishing for those. So they're going to be fun from that standpoint. And then also there's bow fishing. Bow fishing is really rising quickly here in the state of Illinois. A lot more bow fishermen now than there were just a few years ago, and it's really growing. So the bow fishermen will get quite a kick out of them if they happen to get one. But their numbers are going to be so few throughout the state that people will hardly ever even see one, I don't think. We're hoping at some point they do. We can see them more and more, but really, right now the stocking, we're just trying to see if it's feasible and trying to reestablish it. And the females aren't even reproductively mature until they're 11 years old. So this is a long-term process, way on past my years as division chief.
And when it comes to this plan, is there anything else that people ought to know about how you're planning to do this reintroduction?
We're keeping them in the southern part of the state, their native range from when they were here before. There's so many places we could stock them to. We just don't have enough fish. You know, we're going to be stocking. Well, it's hard to say. We get 20,000 fry in each year to raise up, and fry are about the size of mosquitoes. So the survival's not very good. And last year, you noted, we only stocked 1,600. We'd like to be able to stock 4,000 or 5,000 a year. And when you look at the river systems we have, the Ohio, the Kaskaskia, the Mississippi, down south, the Illinois, there's miles and miles and miles, you know, hundreds of miles of rivers and only a few thousand to stock every year. So, you know, it's really a long-term project. We stocked them back in 10, 11, and 12, and then we took a little hiatus for a couple of years. And then we started stocking them again last fall. I know there were some people concerned the Kaskaskia Boating, maybe it's called the Kaskaskia Boating Club, I can't remember what they were, down in southern Illinois, and they were very concerned about the impacts it'd have on skiers and swimmers and, you know, if they bite people and or if your dog jumped in the water, they're going to eat your dog and stuff like that. And none of that can happen. That's just not feasible at all. They're going to take shad. 95% of their diet is shad. And another thing, too, that there was some concern about, they'd eat all the sport fish, eat all the crappies, so fishermen wouldn't have crappie or bass or whatever. And the same thing, if you look at their food studies, it's just very, very little of the sport fish species. It's almost all shad and some other carp. They'll take an Asian carp if they get a chance. They're opportunistic, but they're not going to actually look for certain prey species and go after them or anything like that.
Dan Stevenson is director of the Illinois Department of Natural Resources Fisheries Division. He spoke with IPR's Sean Crawford. You're listening to Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Burn victims don't have to suffer alone. The Knapp Burn Foundation is ready to offer assistance, and community members can help the organization with their mission by putting on some running shoes and helping to raise funds and awareness. Laura Kennedy has more on this edition of the GLT Datebook.
The Knapp Burn Foundation Trial by Fire 5K Run Walk is Saturday, May 20th, beginning at 8:30 a.m. in Tipton Park. Barb Knapp says that the foundation assists burn survivors nationwide with educational scholarships and provides compression garments for burn survivors, plus provides education on burn prevention and more. Tom Nielsen heads the organization and knows firsthand how important their work is, as he is a burn survivor himself.
I was a burn survivor in high school many years ago in 1974, and I was very honored to be asked by Barb to be on the board of directors approximately 2 to 3 years ago.
Yes, he's now our president.
So with this 5K run, how many years have you been doing it?
This is only our third year.
This is your only fundraiser.
Correct.
Why is that?
We have a couple of endowments, and those funds go strictly to the burn survivors, and the 5K is for community awareness, and the funds that we raise help us go out into the community with more awareness and more prevention programs.
Have you had some feedback, Barb, about the work that you've been doing and how that can directly help burn victims?
We have actually had several burn survivors come to our 5K, and for them, it helps them find a community.
How important is it to have a community, Tom?
Oh, it's extremely important. Speaking personally, many years ago, I talked with many of the burn survivors, many of those that were either had more burns than I had or less burns than I had, but all of us went through the same thing. Went through a lot of, unfortunately, discomfort during the burn stages and then a lot of recovery, because in my particular situation, when I was burned, I was 17 years old and had a lot of external areas that showed. And as a 17-year-old, what are you looking for in your life? Appearance. It's all about appearance. So it took a while to get through that. And others that were around me and other burn victims, of course, are very, it's very nice to know those.
At the event itself, it's not just the 5K. You also have the Bloomington Fire Department there.
Yes, the Bloomington Fire Department will be there with equipment. They'll be giving demonstrations. They'll be teaching people how to use fire extinguishers. And also this year, it is Armed Services Day, so the 50 American flags are going to be lining the walk also.
Do you have a really good relationship, the foundation, with the local fire department?
Oh, definitely. They love working with an organization such as this. We can help show what happens if you don't pay attention and what happens if you do pay attention and if you do take the necessary precautions. There were 486,000 burn injuries in the United States in 2015. Most of them happen in the home. And in the home, it's usually smoking and kitchen fires. And I hate to say this, but men taking shortcuts.
Tom, over to you.
Oh, I think that would be absolutely true. There's no doubt that men take more chances, more risks. Okay, so starting the fire correctly is a commonplace. I practiced emergency medicine for 27 years and saw lots of unfortunate people that came in because they tried to start the fire the wrong way. They didn't do it correctly. They didn't use the kindling. They put flammables, i.e. gasoline or other things, on fires. And then what happens? The fire blows up and goes back onto them, and the gasoline can ignites, and there's all kinds of serious problems. And unfortunately, men take more risks than women.
And we're also there, our phone, just to listen. They can call the foundation phone number, and we'll just listen to them talk. We do not give them any guidance because we're not trained in that, but we can listen.
Now, with regards to the event, will there be awards handed out?
Yes, there will. Everyone that wins in each category is going to get a fire extinguisher that's been provided. You can run, you can walk, you can stroll, you can push a stroller, you can walk a dog.
So dogs are welcome. That's good.
Yes, they are. We want families to come out. We want to get people out. We want them to come. We want them to experience and enjoy and help support the burn survivors.
We just want to make people more aware of how you can get burned, what can happen. Prevention, of course, is the key on almost everything in life. But if you can prevent the burns, then we don't have to have the emotional support from those who have been burned. But then we're there if they need to be.
That's Tom Nielsen and Barb Knapp from the Knapp Burn Foundation. The Trial by Fire 5K Run Walk is Saturday, May 20th, beginning at 8:30 a.m. in Tipton Park. I'm Laura Kennedy.
Learn more about how compression garments aid in burn recovery by visiting the Datebook page at WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from Justin M. Boyd, Country Financial Representative, building relationships while supporting and serving the community. Justin offers life insurance options designed to protect your family and leave a lasting legacy. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. Occasionally, John Norton stops by local record stores to hear what's playing on the turntable while customers browse the bins. This week, Reverberation Vinyl on Main Street in Bloomington was the stop, and we'll hear a classic folk artist that's been getting a lot of play recently.
Hello, this is John Anderson, owner-operator of Reverberation Vinyl here on Main Street in Bloomington, Illinois, right across from Illinois Wesleyan University, your heady record store. So what's on my turntable at Reverberation Vinyl? The Pentangle. All right, so why the Pentangle? Well, A, the Pentangle were and are one of my favorite groups, a folk rock group from England from the late 60s, early 70s. They're around for about five records. And Burt Jansch, a famous British folk guitarist before and after the Pentangle, he and John Renbourn were the main two guitarists, legendary guitarists in that group, along with Jackie McShee, Terry Cox on drums, and Danny Thompson on bass, one of the greatest groups of all time. And I listen to them all the time, and especially in the month of May, because 47 years ago this week, the Pentangle played a concert right across the street at Illinois Wesleyan University, which has been at the top of my holy grail local recordings list for a long, long time. Every year during the month of May, I pester and badger people around town to see if anyone has a copy, if anybody's sitting on a copy, knows someone that recorded it. Yeah, 47 years ago this week in 1970, the Pentangle played across the street. So, 1970, by that time, the Pentangle had done three records, and three of their best, which was the self-titled first album, the second one, a double album called Sweet Child, and the third album, Basket of Light, which is kind of accepted as their quote-unquote classic LP. We'll play a couple songs from that one because they were touring that record over here in the States at the time, and several songs from the record were most certainly played at Fred Young Fieldhouse at Illinois Wesleyan University on May 11th, 1970. So we'll lead things off today with one of my all-time favorites, Hunting Song. Okay, so if you're like me, you take an interest in local things to some degree. I'm from here, I'm a townie, and bands that have played here and shows that have happened here over the years are of interest to me. So I was always fascinated, especially after I opened the store, that the Pentangle had actually played a concert like directly across the street from where I'm sitting right now. So I said, it seems to me that somehow, some way, the show was recorded. I've found other recordings over the years of the Pentangle from that tour. I've got one right here in front of me from Berkeley in California from 2 weeks after their engagement here at Wesleyan. And this is one of the songs they played, one of their all-time greats, a tune called Like Wake Dirge. That was Like Wake Dirge, which is maybe the first Pentangle song I ever heard, possibly, actually, on a compilation from a long time ago. But that's one of their all-time greats. And the Pentangle, they had a reputation for reshaping old English songs and old English folk music into a modern context with modern instrumentation. And that presentation was done in a very kind of ancient kind of way, even though it has the very reverbed out and echoey vocals. But on some of the other material, you'd have John Renborn playing a sitar or an electric guitar, which was kind of gasp, you know, sacrilege to old folkies. But, you know, Pentangle had that reputation as a folk rock group, even though there wasn't a lot of rock and roll. It was almost more of a blend of folk and jazz. But they did original material, and they also did a lot of old English folk stuff, which is the next song that we're going to do, a song called Brutentown. Which is, again, one of my all-time favorites, and it's an ancient English song. And all these old English songs, a lot of them were very violent and bloody and sexual and kind of taboo in nature in a lot of ways. But this is one from the Sweet Child album, which is, you know, I think it's my favorite Pentangle record, but this is a song from the Sweet Child LP called Brutentown.
In Brutentown there lived a farmer who had two sons and a daughter dear. By day and night they work and drive to fill their parents' hearts with fear.
So the last tune is a special one, the closest we can get to the Wesleyan show from 1970. And one of the few pieces of evidence I have from the show, my friend Chris unearthed some old newspaper clippings and pantograph, and one in particular is a photo from the Argus, from the Wesleyan newspaper, the Argus. It shows John Renborn from the Pentangle sitting in the foreground of the photo playing a sitar at this concert, and you see Jackie McShee and Burr Jan sitting behind him, and it's a grainy black and white photo, but it's really cool. The song they were probably playing at the time at the show is that features a sitar that they were playing live around that time is a song called House Carpenter. My reason for believing this is that the bootleg I mentioned before, this one here from Berkeley, from 2 weeks after the show, they played House Carpenter, and we will air the live version of House Carpenter from that show up next here. But it's kind of cool to have at least some visual evidence that the show did happen. It said they played to a crowd of 200 at Fred Young Fieldhouse, which is a really small number, but an amazing, intimate show in my mind's eye anyway. Possibly someday We can run across a copy. And I should also say, in terms of other legendary local shows that you maybe wouldn't think of or didn't know of, in 1971, Nina Simone, the great Nina Simone, played at Stroud Auditorium at U-High, which was part of a series of concerts that Illinois State was putting on at the time. And my friend Chris Young, once again, we work on this stuff together and nerd out on this stuff together. But that is his all-time Holy Grail show. So if you're sitting on a 1971 Nina Simone tape from Stroud Auditorium or a 1970 Pentangle tape from Fred Young Fieldhouse at Illinois Wesleyan, please come see me, John Anderson, at River Bridge and Vinyl. I would love to see or hear anything anyone would have from either one of those shows. So we will close up today with this really cool live version, which is the closest we can get to our fabled show across the street, Pentangle. This is a live version from May of 1970 of The House Carpenter.
I see bright hills that tell, my dear, where you and I must go.
You're listening to a live version of House Carpenter from Pentangle from 1970, recorded just 2 weeks after the group played Illinois Wesleyan's Fred Young Fieldhouse on May 11th, 1970. Thanks to John Anderson at Reverberation Vinyl in Bloomington for sharing the music playing in his store, and to John Norton, who produced this edition of What's on Your Turntable. We want to know what's on your turntable. Let us know at WGLT.org or at Facebook.com/WGLTFM. Our website is where you can find the stories and interviews you heard today. Thanks to John Norton, Laura Kennedy, Charlie Schlenker, and Judy Valente. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Tweet about the show. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. We're all at WGLT News. You're listening to, and thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.